Hi, this is Jay Washburn.
And I'm Joe Bondosky.
And this is Start Writing.
And we are continuing yet again our discussion on exposition. We have talked about the ignorance and the outlander. We've talked about backstory and all that. So we have a few more types of exposition to cover. And then we're going to kind of explore the choices between each type of exposition and some of the pros and cons compared directly against each other as we cover the four major types. And then we'll talk about the four pieces of exposition you really need to include in your novel and why. And of course, we'll be digging in with some good examples there as well. So that's what we're going to be going over today. If you're just joining us, then you'd probably want to hit up the I think there's three episodes on exposition. So before we jump in here, you'll want to hit
those definitely up. Do that.
All right. So we're going to talk about now exposition through thoughts. And this is or what we often refer to as interiority. If you're not familiar with the author lingo on that, that's a reference to when a character is thinking in their head. So it's not the author putting out the exposition directly to the audience, it's the character thinking about something in their own way in their head. So, Jay, we've got an excerpt here from Jane Eyre. If you want to give us a reading.
Yeah. There was no possibility of taking a walk that day. We had been wandering, indeed, in the leafless shrubbery an hour in the morning. But since dinner, Miss Reed, where was no company, dined early. The cold winter wind had brought with it clouds so somber and a rain so penetrating that further outdoor exercise was now out of the question. I was glad of it. I never liked long walks, especially on chilly, windy afternoons. Dreadful to me was the coming home in the raw twilight with nipped fingers and toes and a heart saddened by the chidings of Bessie, the nurse, and humbled by the consciousness of my physical inferiority to Eliza, John, and Georgina Reed.
So there's a few bits of backstory in here, you know, chidings of Bessie. And then what we're getting is exposition of why something can't get done. So when you read through us, it really doesn't feel like exposition. It feels like she's just thinking about her day. But there are pieces of exposition in there that are important to the events of the chapter. So in screenwriting, you have what's called a bottle episode, where you take two characters who are avoiding talking about an issue. Usually it's a relationship between the two. And you force them into some kind of situation where they're trapped together for a long period of time. Like if they're trapped in an elevator or something like that. So they call this a bottle episode, where you force these two characters to be together for a long time, forcing them to discuss their relationship in a way that is uncomfortable for both of them. And what you see here, as we read Jane Eyre, is that is exactly what Charlotte Bronte is doing. She is setting up a bottle episode with, preventing them from going outside because the rain is so bad. And so that's the exposition that is taken there. She is saying, this is why we are stuck inside. And being stuck inside, of course, will necessitate them, you know, either avoiding each other for really long, awkward periods of time or just confronting the awkwardness between them.
Man, and I just love that it's doing this exposition, but it's also polishing the character, or like it's bringing out the character. And so it's accomplishing these two things at the same time. I just love that.
Yeah. Yeah. So this works. This works really well, particularly because unless you're looking for exposition, you won't even see that it's there. It's so subtle in everything that's going on.
Now, what happens when someone takes this too far, like too much interiority?
Too much interiority. I think what happens is interiority is classified as a slower pace of writing. Like we are looking at exposition, we're thinking about it. It is our interest and investment as either you're listening to the episode, you're hunting for the ways to do this and improve this in your own novel. Whereas when you're reading a novel, what's happening here is the plot is not moving forward as we're in her head. And you know, we've got two lengthy paragraphs where nothing moves forward. It's all backstory and exposition. Relayed in a very good way that it doesn't feel like that, but it is. And so we've taken two big chunks and we have not moved our plot forward at all. And so too much of this is going to slow your pacing down a lot and the reader's going to feel it, and it's going to feel dull and slow is what happens if you get too much of this technique. Not only that, but so one of the upsides here is that we get, you know, in this specific example, we don't have this, but when you're dealing with exposition through interiority, we get the character's perspective on it. Not only do we get their perspective, but we can get pieces of their perspective that they wouldn't share with other people. So that's definitely a strength of the style. A limitation is that we don't get multiple perspectives on this piece of exposition. So if going back to the earlier example we had of Holden and Amos and learning how, you know, guns work in outer space and how you need a special one. If that takes place in a conversation and a dialogue between those two, we get the exposition. You need a special gun to shoot in space or you'll launch yourself off a planet. Huh. And then we get Amos's spin on that because he laughs and he thinks that's funny that a guy shot himself into space. And then we can get Holden's reaction, whether he says something in dialogue or we just get a facial expression and action beat from him. So what happens is we then get two characters' perspective on that exposition if we've expressed it in dialogue, whereas we're not going to get that in interiority.
Yeah. Cool. So use it like salt. You want it, but not too much.
Well, I think that, like, so the very next section we're going to talk about is we're going to be kind of going over these and presenting multiple sides so that you can look at what is your piece of exposition and what tool do you want to use to put it into your scene. And I think part of that choice will be what the exposition is and how it will work best that way. But part of the choice will also be the other components of the chapter and the characters, right? Expressing interiority through the thoughts is a good way to build character, to help us get to know them better. So if you've got a POV chapter on a specific character, taking an opportunity to express some of that exposition through interiority can help you bring that character out more and develop them, right? Whereas if your pacing's a little sluggish in some part of the chapter, you could look at a piece of exposition and say, I'm going to convert this to dialogue to accelerate my pacing.
Cool. Yeah, should we dive into this?
So we'll dive into this. So when dealing with backstory and exposition, we are looking at the four major ways in which it can be expressed: flashback, direct exposition, dialogue, and interiority, right? And if you've listened to all the past episodes, we've got examples from all of these coming from the Expanse, with the exception of interiority, which we have just covered now with Jane Eyre. With the flashback, it's a very dynamic scene that unfolds, right? It's interesting and it plays out like any normal scene. Now, the downside of it is it takes time to invest and develop a new setting. And sometimes the audience can walk away feeling like the flashback had no importance to the current story. So the way flashback is handled in The Expanse and the chapters we've covered is the opening prologue. So even though it's a flashback, it doesn't feel like it because we haven't even stepped into the story yet. And that's how they manage that risk of the flashback and even remove it, right? There's no risk of people thinking it's not going to have any importance to the current story because the current story hasn't even started yet when we roll that dynamic scene of the flashback.
Well, and yeah, the thing I usually don't like about flashbacks is just that I'm invested in the current plot.
Yeah.
It's pulling us back. And it's usually giving us something else to care about, which is cool, but it's like, well, I don't want to worry about that. I'm concerned about this.
Right.
And yeah.
Yeah. So those are the risks. And like I said, you've got to kind of weigh what's going on in the story. If you've got a really dull scene and it's running kind of flat and you can't find a way to do it, maybe you would look at your exposition and be like, hey, could I convert this piece of direct or dialogue exposition into a dynamic flashback to spice up this scene that feels like it's a little flat?
Yeah. And man, a good flashback, it can be awesome to actually see it and to feel like you're there. I love that.
Yeah. Then in dialogue, we get more than one character's perspective. This is what we just talked about, because someone is being told the piece of exposition and then they have a reaction to it. Now, the risk here is we talked about the as you know bobs, right? Sometimes it can feel out of place or hard to slide in there. Like, why are two people talking about something they both know, or at least something they both should know? Right.
Man, and you see this in bad fiction, whether it's books or television, all the time.
All the time. Yeah.
And it can be annoying once you start to recognize, oh, these two characters are telling that to us, the audience.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really odd and funny. So if we go back to our piece of exposition with Holden and Amos. So in the book, how a regular gun would work in space, and that you need a special gun in space is covered in direct dialogue. Now we created the example of Amos telling a story of a guy he knew who fired a regular gun in space because it's all he had, and just launched himself out, and then they just was drifting forever until he died in space. You know, and Amos thinks it's funny, and he tells this story to Amos. So the interesting thing here is, we put it in dialogue, but we didn't just put in the fact that, you know, maybe they're grabbing their weapons and Amos says, hey, you need a special rifle out here to shoot. Otherwise you'll launch yourself into space. Well, Holden was in the Navy, so he would know about that. So then we have an, as you know, Bob, right? Amos is telling Holden something they both know because they've both been working in space for a long time and they both have some kind of combat experience. But that's not what we chose to do. What we chose to do was Amos tells a story from his past about some guy who didn't know that. And Amos is telling the story not so Holden knows not to use that gun. He's telling the story because he thinks it was funny that this idiot did this. And so that changes it from an as you know Bob to a character moment, but we still get that exposition across.
Yeah, that's super cool. I love that solution.
Direct exposition, of course, the real strength here is it's short and to the point, so it doesn't bog down the narrative. But as we talked about with the memory slots and how memory works with the mind, sometimes this really short, direct approach can actually make it harder to comprehend and remember that piece of exposition that's important to the story. In The Expanse, we see, you know, that's what they've done. There is, you know, it's exposition for like a page and a half right off the bat. Now, part of that is them managing memory spaces, right? They're like, we have some heavy exposition, so you know you are where you are in the sci-fi universe, what the technology is and the possibilities. And they said, you know, we're just going to leverage the fact that you don't know anything yet so that there's lots of memory slots free for us to plug in our exposition.
Yeah. And to me, like, direct exposition is that lets the reader know it, but a flashback lets them feel it.
Right.
And sometimes knowing is enough, but sometimes it's not enough.
Well, and I think with any time you don't use direct exposition, you always are going to run the risk that the audience misses the important thing that they were supposed to learn there. Right. Mm. So, you know, if they walk away from the story with Amos and Holden thinking, you know, Amos thinks it's funny when an idiot kills himself, he's got a little bit of a dark side to him, then they walked away with the wrong point, right? What you're supposed to walk away with is dynamics and physics are different in space because there's no gravity. Anything with thrust, anything with kick changes the nature of combat. And you have to either have a special tool that won't do that, or you have to compensate from it. And you can miss that piece of information in Amos's little story, right? Whereas in direct exposition, you can't miss it. It's the only thing there.
Yeah.
And then, of course, interiority, which we just literally covered, is, you know, we get this in-depth look in their thoughts. We get to see things that maybe they wouldn't even say to other people. So there's literally no other way to get some of these perspectives. But it's not always sharp and engaging. You know, dialogue is a fast-paced form of the writing. The flashback is fast-paced. But we don't have that. This is a little bit slower in the mind of the character. And again, we're still gambling with that. You know, we might miss the important piece of information. In Jane Eyre's little interiority moment, there's a lot about the rain and the weather, and there's some backstory. And you just get a strong feel that she just really doesn't like rainy days or anything like that. And that's the biggest thing you walk away from is her distaste for rainy days.
Yeah.
But that's not the exposition in here. The exposition is that they can't go outside, that we've created a bottle moment in the novel for the two characters to confront each other and deal with whatever is between them.
Man, I'm not familiar with that bottle term, but that's great.
It's a screenwriting term. Yeah, they use it all the time.
Yeah, no, I love it. It's excellent.
They'll sling it at you, be like, we need a bottle episode. Throw these two characters somewhere where they're stuck.
Yeah.
Okay, so now let's talk about the five key points of exposition. And you've heard these terms before, but I'm going to dig really into them, into what exactly they mean in terms of exposition and why we need them in terms of exposition. And that is who, what, how, and why. And I leave out when because when is a setting question, right? Mm. Whereas here we're dealing with, with exposition. And so if I say who and you give me the name of your character, then you haven't actually addressed the exposition essential there. Because Luke Skywalker is the name of the character. But the exposition is that he's a potential Jedi. He is a wielder of the mythic force. He is nephew to a struggling farmer. He is brother of the leader of the rebellion. He's the son of Anakin Skywalker. He's a young man left behind by his peer group, and a man asked to give up his dreams to help his family. And he wants adventure, and he's estranged from his basic family, right? Like, he has the comment, you knew my father, right? So when he meets Obi-Wan, Obi-Wan makes a comment about Luke's father. And Luke's reaction is surprise, shock, and a question. You knew my father? Because he doesn't know his own father. So all of those pieces are part of that who question, right? And that's all the exposition that we need to eventually put into this story to make up its essential pieces.
Okay, so you're saying we need to have a dynamic character in mind. As authors, we need to have a dynamic character in mind with a lot of different facets that relate to the plot.
Right.
And then you're saying, as we're doing this exposition-wise, we need to think about how we expose each of those facets.
Each of these things, character. Yeah.
Yeah, so, okay, cool. And that's the who.
And that's the who, yeah, that's the who. You know, who is, yeah, all of that. Because all of that needs to come out to help us understand the story, right? Like, you know, a lot of the dilemmas Luke faces and the choices he makes are derived from these points of exposition that come from his character. And without those points of exposition explained and seen on screen, we don't realize he's having a dilemma.
It would be interesting to think about how each of those pieces are exposed throughout the films. So Son of Anakin Skywalker, we actually did talk about that in previous episodes, about how that gets exposed.
Yeah.
I know some of the deleted scenes deal with how he was left behind by his peer group. I guess he does that in dialogue.
Yeah, that comes out in dialogue. So he makes a reference.
He's arguing with his uncle and complaining about how his peers already went to the school or to the academy.
Yeah, yeah. All his friends have gone off to the academy already, and he's just left behind to help on the farm. And he's asked to stay around for another year on the farm, even after that's already happened.
Man, and so you have a man who wants adventure. I feel like that's exposed in the beginning. He just goes out at night after the argument, and he just looks at the sky, right, as the twin suns are setting. And that's like, oh, we just kind of see him longing, like he's got this wanderlust going on.
Well, not only that, but I mean, his interest in the rebellion and in being a pilot, I think that also manifests his urge for adventure.
Yeah, yeah.
Like he wants to go out into the galaxy and take place in the grand moments of history taking place.
Yeah. Okay, so at what point do we know he's a potential Jedi and a potential wielder of the mythic force?
So I think that comes into play with Obi-Wan, right? Where Obi-Wan starts training him and teaching him, and that's when that comes into play. Be like, oh, he can learn this and he can do this.
It's almost like we see Obi-Wan teaching him, like he hands him the lightsaber.
Yeah.
He turns it on for the first time. And so I guess it's just really, really subtle we maybe haven't even exposed that, yes, he is a potential force wielder, but we just laid the question out there like, oh, he might be.
Yeah.
And it kind of gets us excited to have that confirmed later.
And so all of these are addressed somewhere in the story, right? If you look at all the points I mentioned here, only one of them is addressed in the second movie. The rest of them come up within the first third of the first movie because we need those exposition points right away. So again, you want to look at it. And again, you're going to, you know, these are the things you need to have, right? Who is the character? And so what is, of course, the defining goal? This is both in terms of the story and the character, right? So the story goal is what that character needs, what needs to happen in the story to define victory, right? Like Rocky is the great example of this. In Rocky, they work really hard to establish the what. And what is not beating Apollo. That is not the what of the Rocky story. He says it multiple times. I just want to go the distance. And what he means is not losing by knockout. He wants the judgment to go to the judges to last all the rounds against it. And like I said, because they work so hard to establish that what very clearly in the movie, then when Rocky loses, it still feels like he won. Like, so much so that I've talked to a lot of people and they're like, doesn't he win that fight? Like, no, he doesn't. But he does have victory. But the terms of the victory are so clearly outlined that even though he loses the fight, he wins the story
plot. Well, so it's been some time since I've seen it. This is exposed through dialogue. This is how it's revealed.
Yeah, it's done through dialogue because he has conversations with a couple other people where, you know, he's talking about the big fight with Apollo and he says, yeah, I just want to go the distance. So the what is defining that. And so, like I said, with Rocky, if we don't have that defining of that what for the story, then when Rocky loses, it's a disappointment. He lost the fight. Like, what was this about? I thought we were watching this guy because, it, you know, it'd be this grand victory, and he didn't. He lost. Because if you don't define that what, then when we reach the moment of victory, the audience won't recognize it. They won't celebrate it.
Yeah.
Right?
Whereas maybe this is simple of me, but I just think essentially what we're talking about here is how would you know that the story is over?
How would you know?
What milestone do you need to reach to know that, oh, yeah, we concluded this story?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and you know, Lightning McQueen, which we've covered, you know, many times in our discussions of characters, I don't think it ever has come out and said the what of the story, but it is very clear what it is. He needs to learn these lessons so that when he loses the big race because he chooses to help King, we still know that's a victory. It's a huge victory. We see it in the moment. Even though he loses the race, the thing he's always wanted, it doesn't feel like he lost in that moment because we know what the what is. The what is that he has embraced community.
Yeah. So the what is friendship. I don't want to skim over this. Like, how do we reveal to the audience, or how does that movie reveal it to the audience, that friendship?
So I think this is a really interesting reveal. And so the what is comes through in the line in the storyline of Doc, who is an old race car and an old champion. And he won multiple Piston Cups. And then after he has his big wreck, he's just discarded, like he doesn't matter. And that cuts deep into his character. And so that storyline makes a few points. One is that winning it didn't define him. It wasn't that grand moment he wanted it to be. And then when no one was there when he fell, that was crippling, right? So the victory was not that sweet. The defeat was crushing. And the reason why is there was no one there.
Well, and so this is a flashback, right? He tells the – well, it's not a flashback.
It's dialogue and setting, because we see like the posters and everything on the setting. And so, yeah, some of it's told in dialogue and some of it's told – just through us seeing the pieces of the story on the wall.
But it doesn't flashback. I almost thought there was some scene.
There might be a flashback. So it could be. I don't remember. It's been too long. But yeah, and so that's what that storyline really helps clarify. You know, the whole story follows that theme, but that storyline really clarifies the what. That winning it will not be what Lightning McQueen thinks it was, because Doc won it, you know, like 5-6 times.
Yeah.
And it was never what Lightning McQueen thinks it will be.
Yeah, well, and so he's essentially saying, if you think this is the big victory, it's not. And so, like, because even the audience at that point is probably thinking, well, he's got to win. And Doc is telling him, no, that's not how this story ends. Or it wouldn't be a victory if that were how it ended.
Yeah, yeah. So that's where they define the what in Lightning Queen. And so that's a piece of exposition you have always got to clarify. What is it? So in terms of like a James Bond movie or novel, right, this is the big problem that the villain is trying to do, whatever he's trying to explode or steal or destroy or whatever, the what is stopping that, right? And that's very clear, you know, and there'll be a scene where M explains the mission to him and what is, of course, accomplishing that mission that he is given.
Yeah.
Right? So the what is always very clear. But yeah, so your audience needs that so that they know what victory is and what defeat is, and knowing what defines victory and defeat tells us, you know, when we're in that all is lost moment, when we're in that, you know, climax and victory, you know, particularly, you know, a lot of stories, these lines are, you know, not as blurry, but, you know, in Lightning McQueen and Rocky, that's a blurry line that needs a lot of clarification. So you got to look at your story and be like, is my climax blurry? And if it's blurry, you need to work really hard on that exposition of the what so that it is clear when the audience gets there.
Man, and I want to call the James Bond example. That's, I mean, technically it's dialogue because someone is explaining it to James Bond. But to me, it almost seems like direct exposition. It's just telling you, really.
It is just telling you, but it fits because of the nature of the story and the characters' roles in it. It flows in, dialogue perfectly because they would have that meeting and he would be told, right? Like that's not out of place.
The briefing.
Yep. So, and the how is of course going to be very similar to the what. This is how we get there. You know, what are the steps needed to get to the what? And the importance here is, again, understanding what is the step forward for the character and what is the step backward for the character. So it's a very important piece of exposition that way, right? When you have, if we don't know what our what is and our how, then your midpoint turn might not have much meaning.
Yeah.
So those are important pieces of exposition early on in the story you need to address. And then, of course, finally is the why, the purpose behind everything. You know, James Bond wants to stop a villain and save the world. It's very simple, right? And doesn't need a lot of addressing there. Rocky wants to prove that he can compete at that level, that he is not the useless bum that people say he is. That's what drives his motivation there.
Man, so now that you've said that, I almost want, like, we have this as an ordered list. Who, what, how, and why. I want to turn that line into a circle because I feel like the why ties back into the who. Like,
yes,
Rocky wants to prove himself. It's because of his backstory. It's because of who he is as a dynamic character. It's the same with Luke Skywalker. Like, his why comes from who he is.
Yes.
And so it almost looped, in my mind, it's looping back around to the beginning, and the why is about the who.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, particularly with really strong character stories, it is a very definitive circle, right? Like, what the character needs is very much based in who they are, right? Yeah. And the why, of course, is part of that. And the how will be the road that they take for all of that. So, yeah. So a lot of stories, you're going to see not a straight line on these, but a circle, each of them just tying back to the one before. So I guess in my series, I wrote the novella, The Broken Protocol, and I had tried to work really hard to build a little bit more of the backstory of Agent Nichols, his role, and to tie it deeper in. And I feel like it worked that a lot of people felt like they knew him better going into the third novel. Or I guess the third book in the series, the second novel, because of that novella, they feel like I really understood him better and his role and why he's here and everything. And it just, you know, connecting that who to the why had really just helped them understand the whole story better. Mm. So I think that it's important to get those connections there to really make sure that you know, it is that nice, easy circle, because it's easier for the audience to follow and connect to, because then, you know, everything makes sense. Of course he's doing this because of who he is, right? Okay, so this was a really interesting technique that I had read about, and I wanted to include it here. It's what's called A and B exposition, making exposition do more. So it's an A and B technique. And so what you do is you say, okay, I need a piece of exposition here. And then you look at what you put in there and be like, how, I guess essentially, how big is this exposition, right? How much could it cover? And so you see if you could take one piece and add a second piece into it without, you know, bloating it too much so that it's doing more than just a piece of one exposition. So let me go into the example because it's really hard to follow. So this was by writer Robert Wood. So here's the example. Jay, if you want to read this, I don't know if you can see me highlighting it here.
Yeah.
Okay.
Once upon a time, 100 years ago, there was a dark and stormy girl. The girl was Russian, and although her hair and eyes and fingernails were dark all of the time, she was stormy only when she thought it absolutely necessary. She had no dressing gown, but she pulled on the jumper her mother had knitted, which came down to the scar on her knee and ran to the floor.
What we get here is she had no dressing gown. She pulled on her jumper her mother had knitted, which came down to the scar on her knee. So what we get here is she needs to get dressed, just as they're starting the story. But then we get a few pieces of exposition. Her mother had knitted her. So this either tells us about the relationship between her and her mother or about the degree of their economic status, right? That their mother is making clothing as opposed to buying clothing. And then we get the second piece of exposition, which came down to the scar, right? So the two just tiny pieces of exposition. Mm-hmm. And either one could have been cut here, but the author has chosen to include both because he's like, I've got one, I'm going to slide the second one in here. And so that's kind of that A and B exposition, you know, and it's not a big piece of exposition. Those are not whole paragraphs of exposition. And so it was an interesting technique that this author had mentioned. He uses another example where he said, there's a kid and he's at home after school by himself, and I think he's talking to a friend, and he mentions that his mom, he says, yeah, my mom's never home, she's always working at the bank. And so what we get here are two pieces of exposition. One, his mom's never home in the afternoon, so that gives us exposition as to why he's always home by himself. And two, we get the point that she's a banker, and the fact that she's a banker comes into play three chapters later where she's accused of fraud. But we get it there because it's that A and B technique. He takes a piece and he just says, it fits here. I can slide it in without it feeling like it's extra. And then I don't have to address exposition later to deal with that.
Okay. I'm not sure I totally follow the A and B thing.
Okay.
So you're just saying, I mean, it's like it's putting in exposition where it fits nicely. I mean, is that essentially the
gist? I don't know if it's saying it fits nicely, but it's like we've got a piece of exposition, the jumper her mother knitted, right? Mm-hmm. And then we say we can add on a second piece because that first one's so small and it feels connected to it, which came down to her scar, right? We can bring up this scar on her knee anywhere, anytime, any piece of exposition. But mentioning that the jumper comes down to the scar allows us to slide in a second piece of exposition. I'm not saying this is great writing, bad writing. It's just a technique that was interesting and I hadn't heard of before. So I wanted to bring it up and to see if maybe some of our listeners would be interested and want to try it.
Man, so I can see myself as an editor saying, okay, the scar comes up at the 50% mark and it's important, but it's the first time I've talked about it and I'm halfway through the book. So I'm going to go back and scan through my book and go, where have I talked about her body or her knee that I could, you know, foreshadow this a little.
Yeah. Maybe slide it in that way. But yeah, so that's why I wanted to bring it up here is I just thought it was really interesting and I'd never heard of the technique before, but I think a lot of times I think the A and B would definitely be something that came up during editing. Like you said, you'd be like, okay, let me find something else where I slide in this piece of exposition so it's not just coming up right before it happens.
Yeah, that's cool. I actually really like that passage. I think it's beautifully written.
All right. So then a last tool is what we call allusion. And this is where you don't actually mention the piece of exposition in any way, shape, or form. You allude to it. And I think this is a complex enough tool that I'm not even going to cover it here. We'll do a separate episode on it. Because essentially allusion is about leaving it out. And I wanted this series of exposition to be about keeping it in, right? Mm-hmm. How do we keep this in? So I think I've mentioned this before. And I know that most writers also work full time. And so whatever writing time we have, we want to spend it on our books. And I'm definitely the same way. Anytime I'm writing, like people throw writing exercises at you all the time. I'm like, when do I have time to do writing exercises? I need to finish my next book. So what I try to do is as we write these episodes and prepare them, I always try to create what I call a revision guide. And so instead of writing an exercise for these things, I write a revision process I can do. So I can take it to my work in progress and use and be revising it while looking at a few specific things from this episode and series to help me improve my writing. So this is for the series. So the first thing I want to look at is an outline revision. I've written my outline and I'm about to sit down because I'm an outliner and I'm about to sit down and start writing my first draft. One of the things I want to do is look at my outline. Does my outline cover who, what, how, and why? Do I have enough in my research, in my back notes to address those exposition points to make sure that they come across clearly in my first draft? So that would definitely be something I would put on my revision guide. The second thing I'd want to, when I've got a piece of deeper, longer exposition or backstory, have I created a need or a question in the reader's mind to do that? Now, we talked about that when we were talking about the Stormlight Archive and Kaladin's backstory, you know, as I'm going through. So that would be something I'd probably address after the first draft. After I've got my first draft, I would look at a point of exposition in the story and be like, okay, what comes before this to generate that need or question in the reader's mind? And then, of course, this would be the next point I would address with reader feedback. And that would be, if I'm getting that reader feedback where they're saying, I don't believe this or I don't understand this, then I want to go through and look at those points and see what exposition could be added to make those moments believable or to clarify what's happening there. And then, of course, make it flow is an exposition point I'd want to do to look at my dialogue and direct and internal monologue, the interiority and flashbacks, and just ask myself, do they contain characterization, how the character feels about that information? Can they be converted into questions and the exposition delivered later on, or can a question be asked sooner? And then could it make a great flashback? So just looking at some of the exposition that way. Mm. And then another question to ask of the exposition I've written into the story would be like, can I convert this piece of exposition into a story from the character's life, like we did with Amos and Holden in The Expanse? And then, of course, the flashback is there a question that a flashback would answer? And is there a moment when a character's motivations are not clear that a flashback would clarify? And can a dilemma be created by introducing an element of backstory? So those would be questions I'd ask for flashbacks. So all of those would be about, you know, taking what we've talked about here in exposition and applying it to a revision of your existing work in progress. Like I said, I disagree with the idea of writing exercises because, you know, most writers barely have time to write as is, you know. And so for me, I'm always more comfortable taking something I've learned and applying it to a revision of a piece I'm working on, as opposed to just writing something that I'm literally just going to toss out.
Yeah, this is excellent. This is a really good guide.
So
revision guide.
So that's the revision guide. So I know I always do this for myself, but I was like, you know, I really need to make sure and include that in the podcast so that we're sharing it with other people. Be like,
excellent.
You know, what's the takeaway here, and how do you revise your work in progress while developing these tools? So, all right. Cool. That's it that for awesome. Me.
Guys, thank you so much for listening.
That's the so if you want to support us, feel free to check out one of our books, Star Child by Jay Washburn, or you can pick up The Skyfall Conspiracy by Joseph Madoff. Yes, so if you want to support us, check out one of our books. That's the end of the episode, so it is time to start writing.